This is episode 436. Have you heard the term food addiction? There's a bit of controversy over whether or not it's real. So today I'm going to answer the question, is food addiction real? And I'm going to share a couple of things about what you can do about it if you feel that you're addicted to food. So before I get the munchies again, let's begin.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome back to another episode of this wonderful show, if I do say so myself. This is a Coaching with Maddie episode, and the idea is that we bring in questions from clients that have been recurring over the years, or topics, or questions that appear in the social media landscape of the world of health and wellness and life challenges and all of that kind of stuff. And whilst I'm an expert on a bunch of things, I don't proclaim to be an expert on everything, but I do talk from personal experience, working with hundreds of clients, and I guess just my life in this world. So this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, dealing with what's really weighing you down, not just the number on your scale. So if you're sick of yo-yo diets or the weight regain that happens after you go on another weight loss sort of trend or fad or 28-day challenge or whatever, you're sick of that and you want to do the real work that's necessary to make these changes permanent, make them stick for the rest of your life, then the link is in the show notes down below or the caption down below. Scroll down, click the link, have a conversation with myself or one of my team, and we'll see if we can support you. Now, today's topic on food addiction, is it a real thing? So it's a very weird topic, okay? And I'm not necessarily an addiction expert, but I would consider myself very well informed when it came to the world of behavior around food, okay? And so I guess when we think about addicts, we think about alcoholics, we think about heroin addicts, we think about all of the kind of addictions that are really, really obviously problematic. Even though some of those people can actually be really high functioning addicts and you don't even know they're addicts, right? And so the thing is though, it's really clear when you're a heroin addict, that's not ideal. That the person knows it, the person's social group usually knows it. And that's why it's one of those really sort of judgmental things in society. You're a heroin addict, that's awful. You're an alcoholic, that's not as judged because everybody drinks alcohol, but you're usually judged because you're usually showing up in life in a very poor way, being unsupportive to kids, spending people's money, gambling addiction, another one that gets a bit of judgment. But the reason that food addiction doesn't receive the same judgment or really is classified in some cases as not being real whatsoever is because it falls into this vague grey category of, is food addiction real? Because we need to eat, because we don't need heroin and we don't need alcohol and we don't need tobacco and we don't need gambling to survive as a human being. And so it falls into this weird space, like, but we have to eat. So at what point does food become addictive? Now, the way that a lot of people classify food addiction is based on brain scans. And I have some thoughts on this, okay? Now, when we scan the brains of people that are addicted to food, quote-unquote addicted to food, and addicted to other things like some of the stuff I've mentioned, the same regions of the brain light up, the reward pathways, right? And the thing that I feel a bit weird about is that as a biologist myself, originally when I started out in my science career and my research career, the thing that we want to do as human beings is to continue being human beings and continue procreating. Now, there's a couple of things that we're driven to do. One of those is to procreate, and one of those is to eat. Okay. And because, and one leads to the other, basically. And they're innate. And what I mean by that is the sort of the driving hormones, your dopamine or your neurotransmitter hormone, where's that conversation or the cocktail that exists within us that drives us to eat and that drives us to have sex and procreate. They're meant to light up the reward pathway in the brain, because if they didn't, the human species would have died out. So the idea that food that lights up the reward pathway in the brain is addictive or is a sign of addiction, for me, lacks context, because we need to be lit up to do that, because otherwise we'd never get off the couch to go to the fridge. We'd never have gone out into the savannah or into the forest or the jungle to hunt the bear or the deer or the kangaroo to be able to feed us and our family, to make us all strong and able to grow up, to procreate and do it again. Okay, so for me, it lacks a little bit of context, right? And the other thing to mention too is that food companies and farmers are two different topics. Okay, so you walk into a supermarket and I would say that there's food which comes from a farm, very obviously, your meat, your vegetables, your fruit, your nuts, your seeds, that kind of stuff. And then you've got ultra-processed food. Now, the ultra-processed stuff is the things that really light up the reward pathways in the brain. Okay, all food does to some degree, but the ultra-processed stuff goes really high. And those companies have spent millions of dollars making sure that they know which combination of food lights up that reward pathway so they can hijack it. And this is not me being conspiratorial. There's conferences, literal conferences, hundreds of papers written, scientifically written, on how to increase the desirability or the stickiness or the craving for a particular food by manipulating the nutrient composition and the chemical composition to drive a human to tap into that evolutionary mechanism of lighting up the reward pathways and driving us to eat so that they can sell more product, which is a fantastic business model. Amazing, right? But the problem that I have is that the ultra-processed food companies doing that, there's a whole conversation about whether they should be allowed to even be in the supermarket because a lot of them are full of toxins and poisons and things that mess up kids' brains and adults' brains and sex lives and bodies. Anyway, rabbit hole. But the point is, there should be two conversations. There should be food and there should be ultra-processed food. Now, what I mean by that is you might be like, Manny, you've just classified those two groups. But you don't walk around a supermarket and hear people say, oh, hey, mum, I'd love some ultra-processed food. It's not a word that is in the language. It's not colloquially used, right? So we need another word to identify things in a bag, a box, or a can that don't represent real food. And the similarity or the comparison that I'd like to draw is that anyone that's listened to this podcast for some time would know that I have a bit of an issue with the idea of the word fats when we're talking about what we eat. Because the word protein and the word carbohydrate, both of those are biochemistry terms that have made their way into mainstream language or communication about nutrition. But fats is not a biochemistry term. The word we use is lipids. And so I'm a bit of an advocate for this movement that I think I started, but nobody's really getting on, is that we shouldn't be calling fats in our diet fats because there's a social challenge around the idea of being fat and fat in our diet being good or bad or indifferent or something we should avoid or something we consume. And so it's messing up the sort of understanding of what's what in our brain because we're using the same word in two different contexts. It should be carbohydrates, lipids, and proteins. And then being fat should be its own thing about obesity, okay? Same thing here with food in the broader context of food addiction, which is that there should be food and then there should be chemical shitstorms or whatever else we call the other category of food because now we can actually contextualize the food chain, if you like, or the supply chain or the people involved in the introduction of these foods into our diet. And what I mean by that is you might start to look at somebody who introduces chemical shitstorms into the supermarket as a drug supplier or a cartel. And I'm obviously being entertaining with my language and trying to be cheeky about it. But to some degree, who is responsible for the obesity and the addiction and the hijacked brains of an entire generation? And at this point, multiple generations of people. Science and medicine is the most progressive and most forward and most amazing that it's ever been. And yet we in the West, and we're contaminating the East and the rest of the world, have the fattest, sickest, and most confusing list of causes of death that happen every day. Like, how does that make sense? Isn't science moving forward? It's like that classic scenario where you look at a photo on the beach in the 1970s, and there's virtually zero people that look anything but amazing, and that's just a normal group of people. It's not a model expo. And then you look at now and it's hard. It's like spot the healthy person. It's very difficult. So I bring up this around the context of addiction because firstly, I don't necessarily think we're really to blame for the situation that we're in because I think companies and corporations that have abused and hijacked the evolutionary pathways in our brain and our body should be held to account. They're arguably responsible for millions and millions and millions of deaths, arguably. But then obviously the way that our world works is that you're to blame because you don't have strong enough willpower or you're not empowered enough, which is exactly why the work that I do with clients goes into the psychology because we are in this world and we don't necessarily all have $1 billion to be able to go to war with some of these companies and spend entire lives and careers trying to take down one part of the food system. It's like a macroeconomic problem that you're dealing with there. So I think, you know, and there's two sides to the idea of addiction as well. And I just want to tap into this as well in regards to personal empowerment is there's one side, which is nutrition, right? So we've just talked about the chemical shitstorm companies or whatever word we decide to all agree upon to describe these foods in the supermarket so that it can enter normal language. But the idea that I'm thinking of is that there's a nutritional aspect, which is you're not getting the right nutrition. The nutrition and chemicals in food are manipulated to cause you to behave in a certain way, which means you buy the product, spend the money, and the consequence of that is your health. The other side is, going back to the we don't all have $1 billion, is the personal empowerment and the social aspect. So maybe the definition of food addiction should be how many times or at what frequency of engagement in this particular activity does it begin to have deleterious consequences on your life? In other words, what I'm saying is, does eating shit food make you fat, depressed, lose your sex drive, disconnect you from social situations, spend all of your money, turn you into a hermit that never leaves the house because you pay Amazon or the local supermarket or Uber to just bring all of this stuff to your house? Like, at what point does it have negative consequences on your life? Maybe that's, you know, in context with the ultra-processed chemical shitstorm food, maybe that physical impact on the body combined with a negative social consequence, maybe that's where we call it food addiction, right? Because just lighting up the pathways in the brain, I don't buy that as sufficient evidence because all food should light up the pathways in the brain. And if you get healthy food really right and you really get the spices right in a way that really tastes delicious, you can really light up that section of the brain when you're putting in some delicious homemade food that's got adequate amount of protein, delicious spices and herbs, and it's just fantastic. And so all of this to say, is food addiction real? And I would say, yeah, food addiction is real. But I would also not be so quick to classify myself or other people as food addicted rather than being hijacked by corporations as a vehicle for them to produce profit. And obviously, we're really mixing physical health and social issues here. But the social side of it for me is about personal empowerment. And it's really difficult because we're surrounded by food. It's everywhere. There's marketing, there's advertising, there's Uber Eats. The second that we're hungry, there's something open somewhere or someone that can deliver us cheap, shitty, vegetable oil filled, sugar filled, messed around with nutrient combinations in them to our house and to our mouth, right? So we have to gain some kind of control, which is not necessarily through willpower. In many instances, it's through healing and emotional empowerment. We have to garner control or latch onto some part of ourselves that we'd like to be better than someone that consumes this type of food. And I guess if you go deep into sort of perspectives around addiction as a concept in any situation, then there's Food Addicts Anonymous and there's Overeaters Anonymous and all of these organizations that help people manage addiction, 12-step programs. I'm not a huge fan of the idea of identifying as a problem or as your problem for eternity, but a conversation another day. But generally speaking, the idea that I prescribe or understand addiction to be, at least at this stage, and that might change, but all addiction is a result of absent connection or a disconnection, intentional or unintentional, from that which is purposeful, meaningful, fulfilling, and true. And when we initially had a traumatic experience or something go on in our life, that disconnection might have absolutely been necessary. It might have been a survival mechanism. But often we go towards these substances as a way to escape our present reality, our conscious present reality, because reality sucks. And in a world where it's so incredibly easy to get away from your reality doesn't actually need to be that bad to be able to want to get away from it. Once upon a time, getting away from your reality took a great deal of effort. So we had a much greater resilience to put up with a shitter and shitter situation or life or burden traumas than maybe we do now because we're surrounded by doors in which we can escape, open the door, step on the other side, we're somewhere else. And in many instances, that looks like food, which is, again, the work that we do is with emotional binge and overeaters. And this is central to the idea of being able to heal that is that if we've been disconnected from what's purposeful, meaningful, and true and gives us a sense of fulfillment, obviously, we're going to pursue that in some other way because aspects of that are absolutely innate to the human condition or the human experience or the human body. And so we still pursue them just in really dysfunctional ways because being in our authentic self or in our own true reality might be a body or a memory or an experience that is dreadful. And so that takes time to heal and process and come to terms with and expose ourselves to step by step by step. And I'm not here to judge anyone's degree of trauma or which or the stories of which you've attached it that mean that you are currently in a dysfunctional relationship with food and or people and or insert drugs, alcohol, gambling, poor choices that cause shit to happen in your life. So is food addiction real? I think yes. I think my answer is yes. But it's not just because of reward pathways in your brain lighting up on a scan. That might be a feature of it. I don't believe it's the way in which we should categorize it, because I think the way that it affects us physically, our physical health, and the social consequences, that's where we really need to pay attention. Because that's where I think it becomes a classification of addiction in a way that becomes meaningful to the person helping and to the person that maybe needs a label to help them identify with what's going on. Is it an excuse or a reason for people to not change? No, absolutely not, right? It should be a call to action. When you've got a diagnosis or a title or a label, that might give you some direction and a pathway that finally makes sense to you. And I would actually argue for many people, slapping on an addiction title is something that they can leverage and manipulate and use as an excuse to behave in certain ways. Not everybody, and I'm not blaming everybody. I'm just giving you a therapist's perspective on what the possible outcomes are. So from here, what do? You get help, you get support, you either join our program or you join other programs or you get a therapist or a counselor. One of the first things you can do, which is going to just change your life, is join a gym. Join a gym. Physical activity, physical movement, one of the best things you can do. Start eating well, start eating whole real foods and not chemical shitstorms, right? Remember, they're two different food groups, entirely different food groups. It's going to be hard. You're going to relapse. Things are going to fall apart. But as long as you've got the right structure in your head and the right scaffolding around how to navigate these challenges, you can absolutely do it. We've done it with over 350 different people now over the last 5 or 6 years. So I feel confident that you can too. Because as humans, we're all pretty similar. We're not that different. And so we've all got challenges and hang-ups and unhealthy outlets in which we try to manage our chaos and reality. And food is just one of those. It's just that we're in a chapter of human history where food is particularly messed up and we're being used as a commodity to make profit, which has probably always happened, but not that I know of in the food sector like it is now. Anyway, all of that to say, you are more than capable of making changes around your relationship with food. And if you feel like you're addicted, start by getting good food in, going towards real food, start by going to the gym, start by dealing with your relationship with food. I know it all takes time, okay? I'm not just throwing around simple solutions to complex problems. I work with them all the time. I get it. Anyway, this one went a bit longer than I expected, but thanks for hanging out with me, because without you, I'd be irrelevant. So thank you. Would love to see your likes, comments, quotes, engagement, posts and stories, 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts are incredibly helpful to keep this thing alive. And let me know your thoughts. Is food addiction real to you? What do you think? We'll see you on the next one. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. other. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is. Loving what you're hearing? Make sure you're subscribed here on your favorite podcast app. Or there's even more waiting for you over on YouTube. On our channel, you'll get to see our fascinating guests demonstrate their techniques in real time. You'll see my animated explanation of complex health concepts made simple, plus all of those you had to be there moments that we mention in the show. The Coaching with Maddie episodes will be there too. We're also creating exclusive YouTube shorts, quick, powerful health tips you won't find anywhere else. And let's face it, if we're going to be doom scrolling, which we all do from time to time, you might as well make it worthwhile. Just search How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast on YouTube and hit subscribe to unlock the visual side of becoming a healthy friend of the show. Because sometimes you need to see it to believe it, and also to achieve it. The direct link is in the show notes below. Come and join our YouTube community.